Welcome to the League of Moves podcast. I am your host, Zachary Strebeck, and today on the show, I have one of my most frequent guests returning again, I think, right, Justin? This is Justin Jacobson from Restoration Games.
That's me. No matter how many times you throw me out, I keep coming back.
I think you've been on here. It might be 4 times now.
I don't know. That sounds right. I'm the norm of the Legal Moves podcast.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you know, you're one of the, I don't have many lawyers that come on the show for a show called Legal Moves. And you are one of the, you know, you're a former lawyer and you run a game company. So actually, maybe you can do a quick intro for those who don't know who you are. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. I mean, technically, I'm still a lawyer. I just do only the fun stuff that I want to do now. So, yeah, I practiced law for 20 years and got totally burnt out on it. And I've always been a big gamer, though. And so I sort of did a lot of pro bono work for, you know, independent publishers and things like that. I would go to Gen Con and put on a legal Q&A seminar as a way to write off the trip as a business expense. And obviously, we did a couple of those together as well. That's where I first met you. And then I sort of, like I said, I got burnt out on the practice of law, had this idea for the game company. One of my clients was Rob Davio, and sort of pitched him this idea on the company Restoration Games. We take old games that are long out of print, modernize them, and bring them back. That's Rob's gig. He's a legendary designer, but among other things, he worked for Hasbro for a number of years, taking a lot of their existing titles and doing new versions of them. He worked on a lot of the old titles that we were interested in bringing back, and basically just made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And, you know, here we are 5 years later now and going strong.
Excellent. And recently you released your Return to Dark Tower game, right? Which looks totally awesome. One of the big features of that game is a giant tower in the middle, right? The titular Dark Tower, which has a ton of different functionality. You first describe what that tower does in the game?
Sure. So the original game goes back to 1982. And it was kind of blew everyone's mind because it was a big electronic tower in the middle of a game board, which was not something that we had seen before. And so when we take an old game and bring it back, we always sort of like figure out what the hook is or what the cool part of the game is, modernize the rest of the game to support that cool part, and then, you know, update the game to modern standards. Mm-hmm. Well, for a game like Dark Tower, you know, it's the tower, stupid, right? Sure. So it's funny, though, when we were, you know, what does that mean, though, right? So, like, the original tower was essentially a really low-level, by today's standards, you know, Stone Age-level computer that was inside the tower. It had a touchpad with a sort of a slideshow screen and then a small LED display that could just display numbers and letters and things like you might see on an old, you know, digital clock type thing. Mm-hmm. And basically you would take a turn, push a button on the tower. It would make some fun 8-bit noises. It would do some randomization. It would keep track of things like resources in the game and stuff like that. But it was all obviously very sort of low level. And then we sort of had to figure out, well, okay, if what would a, you know, this is 30 years later or 40 years later now. Jeez. actually, I just realized it's 40 years. Holy cow. Wow. You know, what is that going to look like? It's obviously going to look very different, right? So we honestly, we've been working on this game forever. It was one of the first games we sort of looked at doing. And I think it was 1981, actually, just occurred to me. And so we looked at, like, you know, what kind of stuff do we need it to do in the game? We spent probably a good solid year. Well, first of all, when we started the company, we spent a good solid year sort of figuring out how we could do the game legally, right? And working on the rights and navigating various other things, because it was definitely murky, to say the least.
Yeah.
But then obviously we got started working on the game design and what we wanted that tower to do. We literally had a spreadsheet where we just listed ridiculous things that we could have the tower do. You know, it's just a brainstorm session where no answer is too ridiculous. Could it, you know, have a smoke machine in it? could it shoot like a laser at a space on a board, not like a heat laser, but, you know, like a laser pointer, right, at spaces right. on the board? Could it shake the board like an earthquake? Could it grow? We actually went so far as to originally, one of the original ideas, very early ideas, one of the very first prototypes we looked at was essentially a tower that was collapsed. And as the game progressed, it actually grew and like telescoped from this foundation into a full tower. Mm-hmm. So those were all things that we were looking at. Meanwhile, we're also working like on the game part. What are we going to do about the game? Because honestly, the tower in 1981 was super cool. The game part was, by today's standard, pretty bad, honestly.
Yeah.
Pretty boring and long and a lot of luck and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, it was great at the time, but so we were working on that too.
Yeah.
And then obviously we have to figure out how to basically make those two work together in a seamless way so that they're interesting and cohesive and all that. So it was a massive, massive project. And it started with mostly just Rob and me and this weird ideas. Isaac Childress was in obviously pretty early too, although he was working more on the game design than the tower design. Mm-hmm. We brought Brian Neff and Noah Cohen on the team, sort of in the middle where we had thrown out a lot of the kookier things, and we're starting to hone in on what we wanted it to do.
Excellent. Well, we are not a game design podcast. We are this is more about the business of games. So what I wanted to have you on here for is to talk about the actual, I guess, the behind the scenes manufacture and production and dealing with all of that stuff when it came to the tower. You know, I think it's becoming increasingly common for games to have these kind of more complex parts, whether it's miniatures or more elevated assets in the game or things like this tower. So what kind of challenges did this introduce, I guess, in your design process when trying to figure out the limits of what you could actually end up producing and then in the manufacturing process?
Yeah. So we ultimately, what we decided is that we knew we needed, like, today there's a computer in your pocket that is, you know, 1,000 times stronger than the computer that was in the tower.
Yeah.
I'm talking about obviously your smartphone. And so sort of where we settled on fairly early was we needed it to be app enabled, because to get the same level of wow today, you're not going to be able to do it on some self-contained electronic device. And importantly, it wouldn't be as strong or as powerful or be able to do as many things as your phone. But also, if it wasn't sort of integrated into the actual game board, its location in the center of the game board, then we were worried that basically people would just sort of leave it to the side and, you know, play the game and then use the tower kind of thing as two sort of separate pieces.
Right.
Which was also the same reason one of our original thoughts was, hey, we'll just make the tower a really cool looking, you know, phone stand. Basically, you slide your phone in and it spins around. And but then we realized the same thing, like people will just pass the phone around and the tower will look nice off to the side and just be pretty.
Yep.
So we knew we sort of needed to integrate it physically in the board. And so that's when we sort of came to this idea of essentially a skull tower, which is, I guess, like a cube tower or a dice tower. In this case, we wanted to use skulls because skulls are badass, mm-hmm. much cooler than cubes.
That's right.
Evil, you know. But we also, obviously, we didn't want to just have a physical tower, because that would be sort of a downgrade, right, from what the original tower did. Like, so we needed it to be electronic. So we sort of had all these little things, these little like elements that we wanted to figure out to integrate in the tower. Like, we wanted to integrate into the board. It had to be important that it was centrally located in the board. It had to do something physical, but it needed to be electric in some way. We wanted to have the power of an app. And so this is where we, over time, as we sort of coalesced these various elements we had, and it sort of brought this big picture of what the tower would look like, which ultimately what it is now is it's a physical tower that you drop skulls into. And what the skulls do is there's a physical element where they can stay in the tower, or they can also drop out of the tower onto the board, which has meaning in the game. But then there's also an electronic element. And so one of the things we sort of did early on is the idea of the app knows. So first of all, the tower had to talk to the app. Mm-hmm. So that meant it had to have the best way to do that was this Bluetooth connection. So there's a Bluetooth connection between the tower and the app, so they can talk to each other. The app can tell the tower what to do, and the tower can tell the app what it's doing. And so then we put an IR sensor in the top of this tower. So normally you just drop a cube in a cube tower or die in a dice tower, and it just goes through and does something. Well, here, when you drop the skull in, the app knows that you've dropped a skull in. And so that we figured out a way to make that meaningful, in that it basically at the end of your turn, you drop the skull into the tower, and that lets the app know that your turn is done. And what that also has the benefit of doing is creating essentially a ritual out of the game. Rituals can be very powerful experiences in games. And so it really works well in that sense. Like the ritual of taking a skull, dropping in the tower, the IR sensor reads it, so it'll light up, it'll make cool sounds. The app will make a noise because something happened. You know, there's an event that occurred that the app will tell you. Meanwhile, the skull is either staying in or coming out, which can be very bad in the game. So there's that slot machine moment where it's very exciting, right, of what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Then in addition to that, we wanted to do something cool with the actual sort of guts of the tower. Whereas in a normal like cube tower, they sort of stay in and then you drop another cube in, it might knock it out, it might stay in there, whatever, whatever. We actually wanted to essentially make that mechanical, that aspect. And so what our tower has is it's four stories tall, like levels. The bottom level is open. So you can drop a skull in. If it gets all the way to the bottom, it's going to spit out. And there's four sides to the tower because there's four kingdoms, you know, on this circular board. So it'll come out one of those things at the bottom. It comes out into your kingdom. You've got to put it somewhere. Something bad happens. Or and these three other levels have holes in them also, but they start the game with these seals on them that actually block the skulls from coming out. So if the skull bounces around when it goes in and it lands into one of those channels on the side, it'll just sit there until later in the game. Again, the app will tell you, okay, I'm going to show you which seal on the tower you need to remove. And it makes this big noise and it lights up and the actual seal will light up which one you need to remove, and you lift it up and it might be nothing behind there. There might be a bunch of skulls that tumble out now that have been collecting, and that's always an exciting moment. Or it might be a glyph. So some of the faces actually have like a sigil that again is lit up, and that has a game impact. But then what's interesting is each of those three levels, we call them drums. They're these like cylinders, smaller cylinders mm-hmm. within the tower, have again these openings or these glyphs or whatever. Those can each rotate individually as well. And again, that's directed by the app. So there's some really cool moments that we can build into that, where we can have, so the skulls might build up, right, like behind one of the seals, and there might be an opening on another side, and then all of a sudden we tell that drum to rotate, and all those skulls rotate over to the open one, and they just pour out. And that's where we get some of the most exciting moments in our game. Right. Because first of all, it's theatrical, right? There's lights and sounds. You can hear the gears turning. So you really have this visceral experience mm-hmm. of the mechanical aspect of it. And then you have the exciting, like I said, the slot machine paying off. It's like an evil slot machine, so it's bad. But it's exciting still. Machine.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And so all of that builds into what the tower does, and again, how we got to that aspect. Now, there's a whole team of people that I probably should mention who sort of helped develop all this. And that's where we get into the interesting. Like, that's sort of the story of how the tower was developed from the bird's eye view.
Right.
But each part of that, there's a lot that goes into it.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I mean, go on.
Yeah, so we had about a year or so of early development on some of the game design, thinking about what we wanted the tower to, et cetera, et cetera. Then at PAX mm-hmm. Unplugged, I want to say it was it 2018, I think? Time has no meaning anymore because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
It might have been 2018, but it might have been 2019. We actually had a meeting with Tim Burrell-Sayward at PAX Unplugged. He is an engineer, but he also works in the game space. Mm-hmm. Most notably worked on a game called Beasts of Balance, which is a very cool electronic game. It's a stacking game with an electronic Bluetooth-enabled platform that you'd stack the animals onto. And each of those animals has a chip in it, so the game knows what animals you're putting on and if they happen to fall off, and it's all very cool, which is sort of like the kind of thing that we were looking to do with the tower. And it also is integrated with an app. So Tim, we talked to Tim about sort of bringing him on as a project manager and to oversee this engineering process. Great. Then we get down into the nuts and bolts of it, and now this is where we literally have a team of probably 12 or so engineers of various types. We have a mechanical engineer. We have an electrical engineer. We have our engineering consultant who's in China, who's working with the manufacturer. I'm sure you'll want to talk about that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Andrew Sung, he was very important. Bruce was our electrical engineer. We actually had a bunch of engineers who essentially were assistants for Tim in designing the tower, doing, you know, the circuit board, you know, helping Charlie and Andrew with the circuit board design, designing the gears and the structure of all that, of all the interior workings of the tower. And all that work is going on over this whole period of time, refining it, testing it, getting prototypes from the manufacturer, you know, testing it again, making further refinements. Meanwhile, we're designing the game part and we're playing with it. Originally, the tower was 5 stories tall. And we said, we don't need that extra story. We just chopped a story off. Things like that. Originally, the seals were held onto the tower with magnets. And the app would, when a seal was going to be removed, the app would turn off the magnet and the door would literally just fall off. Mm-hmm. Which was extremely cool the first time and incredibly annoying just about every time after that. So we quickly got rid of that. But that's sort of like, in a nutshell, like how this whole process went. Lots of people, sort of iterative design, back and forth between, you know, the engineering part that we're in. Meanwhile, I haven't even talked about the app. We also had an app developer, Bjorn, with Porcelain Fortress. He's working at the same time because he's got to develop a beta app or prototype app that we can use to test the tower and also test the game. And this is all very complicated because these are all moving parts on essentially these 3 different tracks happening at the same time where we're giving feedback to each other and in real time, and incredibly just massive, massive undertaking.
Yeah, because I'd imagine you were still refining and changing the gameplay through the whole through this whole process, right? Which then has, you know, butterfly effects that changes the app, and the app changes the tower design and all that. Yeah. So how do you maintain quality control, and how do you deal with the prototyping and all that when they're being manufactured in China? Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah. Okay. So like I said, we had essentially an on-site engineering consultant, Andrew Sung, mm-hmm. who lives in China. He worked with Tim on Beasts of Balance and I think some other projects. He's an engineer. He's also worked with game companies before, among other things. He works closely with some of the factories, you know, in China, working with factories for various other projects. So he was invaluable. Tim was essentially doing the project management for us and also in particular heading up the engineering part of it. And so they were constantly working back and forth with the engineers at the factory. I should mention it was manufactured by a company called Capable. In China,
and just they the tower would, or the entirety of the game.
So this was a really interesting project. We decided it just to give ourselves one more layer of degree of difficulty. We normally have published all of our games with almost all of our games with a game publishing company called Panda, who probably mm-hmm. a lot of people who are familiar with games know. They make all our prior games. They do lots of games for lots of publishers, but they do not do electronics, and Capable make a lot of electronic stuff, but they don't really do a lot of games. And so they would have had to outsource a lot of the printing anyway. So what we ended up doing is we had Panda basically make everything except the tower. And then that got shipped over to Capable, who then assembled everything. You know, they were manufacturing the tower and then assembling the games for shipping. So that was a huge challenge. And meanwhile, again, Andrew's in China helping oversee all this to make sure everything's running smoothly.
Yeah. So it sounds like the lesson here is if you're doing something complex and crazy like this, I mean, the way to deal with it is to get capable people who are experts in this kind of stuff to handle all of their parts, right? I think
yeah,
it's really difficult for someone like you to be handling all this stuff yourself, I would imagine.
For sure. And I would say in particular, having Andrew local at the manufacturer is you couldn't do it without someone there locally.
Right.
Because there's so much, I mean, just the time difference even, honestly, but just being able to go to the factory and see what they're doing and having a better, you know, being able to see it rather than trying to do it on some Zoom call or something or just in pictures in an email. It just, it's so such a complicated process that it's really the only way I think you could do something like that.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing that's maybe a little more common than complex towers in games is miniatures and things like that. It's definitely kind of all the rage these days. You have miniatures in Return to Dark Tower. I think you have miniatures in lots of your other games too. What is that process like? And what are some of the major challenges you deal with just getting miniatures in the game?
Sure, sure. So obviously, order of magnitude easier than something like the tower, but still definitely a step up from something just like a board game, cards, things like that. Couple reasons. First of all, you've got materials, and then the process for actually making injection molded plastic, you know, figures and things like that is different and has its own whole set of sort of rules and quirks and things like that. So first of all, you need a sculptor, you know, digital sculptor, generally speaking these days. We have a few that we've worked with on various projects. They're all really good. They'll come up with this. They're the artist, essentially, who will come up with this 3D representation of the figure, and that comes with a file. Well, then that needs to go to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer will tell you if they can actually make the thing that the 3D sculptor created. Now, good 3D sculptors, who we have the benefit of working with, are usually pretty close, right? But then you'll get it to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer will be able to take it and say, you know, here's where we see problems with it. Or one of the other things that you'll need to look out for with 3D making manufacturers is there might be the poses or like the dimensionality of it can affect, for example, how many it might be something that needs to be run in different, like two separate pieces that are then glued together. There might be things that just can't be done if, you know, if you have certain cavities, it's hard to describe, but if you had like a, you know, like our buildings, if they had a big tunnel through them, like that would be a whole separate thing that might make it hard to make, things like that. But even something as simple as like, we got a miniature of for one of our games Unmatched, guys holding a sword, and, the sword, you know, as the sculptor makes it, is a little too thin. So they have to make the sword a little thicker, that kind of thing. Yeah. So depending on the manufacturer you're working with, they should be able to. So Panda's one thing they're great at is that sort of stuff. They'll come back and show us an image of their 3D, essentially people will get in there and they'll tweak the image and say, here's what we can actually make, you know, in the real world. And they'll highlight the little areas like the sword's a little thicker. We need to make this a little more upright, things like that. And they'll show you a final thing and then you might approve it. And then at some point you're going to get, so with the 3D miniatures and things like that, one of the big expenses is what's called tooling, which is literally where they make a big metal mold to, you know, make the figures. And that's where you're spending a lot of money. So you want to make sure at that point that you're getting, when you actually start the tooling, that it's, you know, that you're it's what you want it to look like and it's going to look okay. And at that point, they'll run some test sculpts as part of like their pre-production copy, along with copies of your cards and your board and all that stuff. And they'll send that to you so that you can approve the final sort of look of everything.
Do they do preliminary like 3D printed versions of it? Does that help to do that? Or is that like a totally different, are the issues with 3D printing totally different than with the tooling and, you know, like the, like you said, the thickness of the swords, or maybe the arm is too far from the body or close to the body or what have you, you know, whatever weird thing works and doesn't work in a miniature?
Yeah, I mean, it's really different. Not really, because so 3D printing is you're literally like building, you're just putting the parts that are there and you're like building it a layer at a time, right? And just, you know, putting more material down and building it up. And then obviously you can do a lot of things where part of the 3D printing might include like structures or struts that are then snipped away and filed away. And you might end up with something that looks pretty close, but it really doesn't matter. I mean, you can just sort of look at the 3D image and know what it's going to look like. Sometimes we do 3D printing for things if we want, like for a prototype, so that we can get people play testing or things like that, and be able to take images or video of people playing with it. We don't have those actual injection molded ones, but in terms of the process, it's not really similar. So there's things you can do with a 3D printed model that you can't really do with an injection molded model. But you know, they're just different. Like the 3D printed model is going to have a lot of, you know, rough features to it. You can't get the level of detail generally that you can with injection molding and things like that. So yeah.
Okay. All right. And then I guess to wrap this up, do you have any advice for game designers who maybe are thinking about getting either miniatures or complex, game pieces in their games?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, obviously you want to make sure it's worth the juice is worth the squeeze, so to speak, right? Like anytime you're adding anything complex, I mean, obviously miniatures is you know, a half step up from cards and boards and stuff. And then if you have something as intricate as like a tower, then obviously that's a much bigger process and a much bigger commitment. So you want to make sure it's worth it, it's necessary to the game or whatever. But if it is, it's all doable. The bigger or more complex the component or feature of your game, the more you're going to need someone who's really specializing in that, right? And in that case, that's fine too. Just obviously you need to have the resources to be able to pay these people, right? Like they're not working for free. But then also just make sure you get recommendations. I mean, generally speaking, game publishers in general are obviously really helpful to each other in terms of like recommendations or helping people find people. I'd be happy to, anyone involved in Dark Tower, be happy to recommend them. They all did an amazing job, and be happy to put someone in touch with someone if they needed something like that. Obviously we've got a number of 3D sculptors we use. I'd recommend any one of them. So yeah, I think it's, if you're getting to that road, and obviously, and I want to be clear, if you're a game designer, okay, that's sort of like a separate thing, right? Like, if you're not publishing it, then you're going to have to be able to convince some publisher that it's worth them putting this investment in to make this game, right? Right. So just keep that in mind as well. But if you're a publisher, even if you're, you know, relatively small publisher trying to do something a little bit more hitting above your weight, so to speak, with some of these complex issues, it's doable, especially in the age of like crowdfunding campaigns, things like that. I mean, that's what they're designed for, right? Honestly, something like Dark Tower, Return to Dark Tower, we could not have done without Kickstarter, just because we had $1 million in development costs for Return to Dark Tower, between the tooling, the engineering, the app, the illustration, all that stuff. So literally couldn't have made it without Kickstarter. So,
yeah. And I guess, well, and real quick, I guess that brings up another question. I mean, what are there any considerations? I know that it's difficult to present a game on Kickstarter that is, you know, at the bottom tier is $100 and some game, right? I think it's definitely more common now than it ever has been. But I mean, how do you sell these expensive games to players?
I mean, it has to be special, right? Like in our case, we had the leverage of the nostalgia for the original game that we had. You know, we put our heart and soul in that game. We had, you know, Isaac Childress and Rob Davio designing the game. You know, people know it's going to be good. You have to, your game doesn't need to be done, but you got to be pretty close so that people can see that they're, you know, it's not a vaporware or, you know, a pipe dream or something, right? Like, so it's a lot of work for sure. But again, it's doable if it's something you really want to pull off. You just, you know, got to be able to put in the work and get enough done for it. By the same token, I think, you know, if it's something that, like, on the one hand, if it's something really unique and really exciting and complex or whatever, like all of these things. On the one hand, that makes it very challenging. But on the other hand, that's what's going to draw people in, right?
Oh, for sure.
Like, yeah. I mean, you know, is someone going to spend $190 on a really good Euro game? Sure, there'll be some. probably more than I would think, but it's a lot easier if it's, you know, also comes with like a really cool Bluetooth enabled app assisted, you know, electronic mechanical tower, right?
Yeah, or a big sheep and, you know, bale of hay or there something in the middle of the board. Exactly. All right. All right. Well, that's all we've got for this episode. Thanks again for coming on to the show, Justin.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. Our website is restorationgames.com. I'm most active on Twitter, which is at restorationgame, no S. And then we actually have a really great Discord. We started that about a couple of years ago, and it's really turned into a great community. So do check out our Discord if you can.
What do you do? It's like a hashtag Restoration Games.
I don't know how that works.
is it linked?
I always do it by link, but it's, yeah, okay.
Okay. I'll let the listeners figure that one out. All right. Good talking with you. And listeners, you can find me at gamelawyerblog.com. And as always, please share the podcast, leave a review on iTunes or wherever it is you listen. And I will talk to you all next time.